Yeah, just say something.
Hello. Now this gets a little bit tricky because the location of that is not very good, so we might get a little bit out of sync here. We'll see how we go. Yeah, not good for me. So, usually we start at the very beginning, but this time we're not going to. We're going to kind of start in the middle of Sandy's life, and we're going to start with her wedding.
Simply because it's an awesome photo.
Simply because it's very unusual. So would you like to tell us about this wedding day you had in Papua New Guinea?
Yes. I was teaching in Papua New Guinea when I got engaged and then married my husband, and neither of us had friends in our hometowns. He was from New Zealand, I was from South Australia, and our friends had long scattered. So we said, the mission people said, have a wedding here in New Guinea. We'll do it all. So they did. Yes, there were no wedding cars or all the usual things you have at a wedding, but they made do.
And your family went up?
Yes, my parents came up. Dad carried the wedding cake on his lap the whole way. And only one little bit of icing got broken, and one of the missionary ladies knew how to do cake decorating icing, and she was able to fix it. So they came up, and Chris's father would have liked to have come, but my father's a pilot, and if Dad had flown the plane himself, he would have come with him, but that didn't happen. Dad came commercially. So, yes, my parents were there, and, part of the wedding.
And how did you get your wedding dress?
We went into Mount Hagen, which is about an hour away by dirt track, and had a look in the shops, and the only white fabric they had was what you might make a tennis frock out of or maybe a baby's dress, and there was nothing suitable for a wedding dress. So I sent a message to a friend who lived in Port Moresby and said, can you find some white material that would be suitable for a wedding dress and send it to me on the plane? Well, there was a riot in Papua New Guinea, and all the white people were told to stay locked in their houses for a while, so she wasn't able to shop, but eventually she shopped, sent me some material, and then I made my dress.
Right.
So, on a treadle sewing machine, because there was no electricity.
Oh, okay. So we're going to take you back to the beginning now. Now that we've got you to your wedding day, we're going to take you back to the day you were born. So we'll go back to Mount Gambier in South Australia. And as you've told me, you always have a public holiday for your birthday. That's clever, Anzac Day. So would you like to tell us about your family life in growing up in Mount Gambier?
Mount Gambier was then, and I think still is, the second largest city in town in Mount Gambier, but it was only 16,000 people at the time. And my parents lived in town. They had their own house. Initially they were renting and then they bought their own house there. My father was an accountant, and they considered themselves one of the proper families of Mount Gambier. They were not churchgoers, but they believed in behaving like Christians should. They didn't drink a lot. Dad gave up smoking, and we were raised to be very polite and a good upbringing. They were lenient, strict parents, but they were good parents. And I had a brother and a sister.
And in keeping with what we've heard from other people here, you took up the bagpipes.
Yes. Being born on Anzac Day, you go and watch the parade. And the early settlers in Mount Gambier, South Australia, where I was born, were Scottish. And at that time, they had four pipe bands in that town, three of them ladies' bands. So the minute I showed them interest, because they all came and marched on my birthday, my father said, oh, good, found the name and the place, and sent me off to have lessons immediately when I was 11.
And you did very well at this. I think there's a picture now of you overseas doing this.
Oh, okay. This was much later. This was in the 2000s and mm-hmm. 2012. In the pipe band there, we were invited over to Belgium to the town of Ypres, because, and we had an invitation there to take part in their tattoo. When they invited us, we just laughed and said, oh yeah, right. And we thought about it, did a lot of fundraising, and off we went to Ypres and performed. And being Mount Gambierites, where it's cold and wet, it didn't matter that it rained that day.
And you won some awards, I think, piping, didn't you?
When I was a teenager, I did solo piping. I was trained by a person who was then the Australian champion piper, solo piper, and I did some competition work, and I managed to become junior champion one year when I was just before my 15th birthday.
And at a later date, you went overseas to explore your Scottish heritage, didn't you?
Yes. That was in Australia, actually.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh. I thought, I was imagining you in Scotland with that one. Okay.
No, it was in Portland, Victoria.
Okay.
We had a family reunion, a celebration of the arrival of our ancestors in Australia. And they arrived in a ship in the 1800 and something in Portland, Victoria. And so they had the Portland people had erected a wall for all the arrivals, and you could put a plaque on it with your family's name. So we had a clan gathering there and put our pipe flag. I'm wearing the clan tartan, the Cameron of Lochiel.
So in your growing up in Mount Gambier, eventually you went off to Teachers College. Would you like to tell us how you became a Christian? Because you weren't a Christian in your early days, were you? How were you living as far as church was concerned in your early days?
I was religious. Somewhere around about 11, I think, an aunt said I should go to Sunday school. And so my parents took me along. And then when I still wanted to go to Sunday school, they said I could ride my bike because they wanted to stay in bed and read the paper on a Sunday morning. So I went to Sunday school, I went to youth group, I joined a crusader group at high school, and I was very religious because I felt that if I didn't do a quiet time every morning like they said I had to, then God would strike me dead or something. I believed that there was a God, but that I'd be careful because he was a gruff, grumpy God, so that he had to do the right thing or else.
So how did it come about that you actually found a faith in God?
When I was at Teachers College, in the third year, I went flatting with a friend who was raised as a fairly strict Methodist and who hadn't been to church for a while. And when we started flatting, she decided that she thought she should go to church. And I said, well, I will come with you because I'd had all this teaching beforehand. And so we looked at the churches. We found a Presbyterian church that was close to where we lived because, of course, there was no transport on a Sunday. We went to the Presbyterian church and the minister was a very elderly Scotsman who had a very broad accent and we couldn't understand a word he was saying. So then we looked around and said, what else can we go to? Because I had been sort of nominally Presbyterian and she was Methodist. And we thought, the next closest church is Baptist. Oh, terrible Baptists. They baptised.
Careful now, careful.
It's all right, that's what we both believed. But we thought, well, it's the nearest church, so let's go and see what they're like. And they turned out to be lovely people. And while we were there, they had a visiting evangelist come and run some meetings. And that's where he did a very good evangelical speech and had an altar call, and I was compelled to go forward to it. So then I gave my life to Jesus and...
So how old were you
then? I was 19, just, yes.
And it was it from there that you started to look towards Papua New Guinea? Was it from that church?
Not from that church, but when I went home on holidays, I went to our local Baptist church. And the pastor there one day called me into his office during the holidays when I was there and said, I've got an article here about the Baptist Missionary Society wanting teachers in Papua New Guinea. Would you be interested? And I thought about it, and then everywhere I looked, everybody I saw, everybody was talking about or writing about Papua New Guinea. So I finished off a year. I had to do 3-year bond teaching. So I finished off my third year and headed off.
So we'll get you back into Papua New Guinea. What were you teaching up there?
I was teaching in a little village primary school. The Baptist Mission ran 6 different village primary schools, not connected to any township or anything, just out in the middle of nowhere. And there was a mission station usually located somewhere near it. Mine was about a kilometre or so down the road, so I went on a motorbike. And I was teaching in a teaching primary school. The kids were aged somewhere between 11 and 14 or 15, because nobody knows how old they are. Nobody has birthdays. And so they just turn up at school when they have to pass an entry test to go to school. And when they're deemed old enough by looking at their teeth and seeing if they can put their hand across and touch their ear, because apparently before you get to 7, you cannot do that. And so that was a test.
So what were conditions like that you were living in? I've just shown the staff toilet at the moment.
Right.
Looks as if it was on public view.
But it doesn't look like that. The three walls that it does have were shielding you from the public, because out the front was a drop straight down over a cliff. So nobody was going to go. They're just the narrow walk along the front of it.
It's a real long drop toilet?
Yes, there's only the only toilets you have there are long drops. Everything is long drop. Your rubbish. They come and dig you a hole for your rubbish and dig you another hole when your hole's full and dig a hole for the toilet.
Now, I'm showing a picture of the Sing Sing girls. Would you like to talk about them?
Just like they organise things for school children, we organised a inter-school Sing Sing for the children. The 3 different schools that were reasonably close, they could get there on the back of a truck. And so the parents came and dressed their children up for this Sing Sing. And those were some of my girls.
And you saw your pupils baptised up there?
Yes, 3 of my older girls. There was a revival going on and a lot of baptisms. To be baptised in Papua New Guinea, first of all, you had to dig the baptismal pool out and run a channel from the nearest water source, and then they could be baptised. Well, once they got the pool there, a lot of people wanted to be baptised, and 3 of those were my pupils, Mary, Martha and Biap, and they were all about 14 or 15.
And you had a visit from the Duke of Edinburgh while you were up there?
Yes.
This is rather topical when we've got King Charles visiting here at the moment, but yes, tell us about that.
Yes, the Duke of Edinburgh came up to Papua New Guinea and wanted to visit the local bird sanctuary, we were the closest airfield across the road from us. There was a government airstrip across the road. And so he landed there and we marched the children across down the road and across the airstrip. And he came over and talked to me and shook hands and had a chat with me, and my friend forgot to take a photo.
Don't know if you saw on TV last night, it looked rather rude that someone gave the camera to our Prime Minister to take a photo of her with the King, and he duly took the photo. I don't think she probably should have done it. So how did love blossom in Papua New Guinea? How did you come to meet your husband, Chris?
Twice yearly, I think, conferences of all the people on the mission stations. We all got together for a week-long gathering, conference. We had teaching and shared things. And Chris was part of one of those, and I got to meet him. And then one Christmas, I went to stay at one of the other mission stations, and he was staying there too, so we got to chat there.
I had the feeling that Love Blossomed at a maths conference. Was that right?
I ran a maths in-service training course at one stage for the teachers there, and he came to that. So that was part of it.
All right.
So now we had a lot in common.
Yes, so that's where things began in Papua New Guinea, but at a future date you returned to New Zealand, which is where Chris came from, and you lived there for quite a long time.
Yes.
So how would you describe your life in New Zealand? Because that was where you brought up your children, wasn't it?
New Zealand was a sort of there was nothing remarkable happened, except that I got had three children, which is remarkable, but it's sort of, it's what everybody does. You have children. They were easy births. There were no dramas or anything. I had a daughter. And then each of them is two years, 4 months apart. So that three children.
That's neat.
Yes, it wasn't planned that way, but it
yes.
happened that way.
So what about your faith journey in New Zealand? What was your Christian experience in New Zealand?
We started off in New Zealand in a little town called Tokoroa, which is a little timber town. And we went to the Tokoroa Baptist Church. And at that time, in the 1970s, there was quite a revival going on in the Baptist College in New Zealand. And a lot of the pastors were coming out and discovered the Holy Spirit. And they were full of the Holy Spirit. And they came out into the churches and started. Our pastor did it quietly. He just found a few people who were interested and sort of started a little group. We weren't part of it. I thought they were odd. Because this Holy Spirit, oh, that's supernatural, that's scary stuff. You won't go there. But I did like the people who were part of that group. They were very nice people and they were always happy and they were very friendly. And so gradually over time I decided maybe it wasn't such a bad thing after all and I was willing to explore it. So I think they had an altar call or something. I can't really remember, but I said, okay, yes, I shall pray for the Holy Spirit. And yes, I believe I was filled with the Holy Spirit then, but...
I don't think they thought you were, did they?
They didn't think I was, because I didn't speak in tongues. And they said, but you should be speaking in tongues. And I thought, well, okay, maybe I should, but...
But you did feel that you'd been filled with the Holy Spirit.
I was quite sure that people did tell me that I looked different. Mm. They said, you look different and you sound different. And I felt different because I started to know things about people. I would say, I've got to go and tell this person I've got a song for them and get them to play it because she was a musician. Or I'd ask what to write in a card and I'd get a message. And I was in a circle praying and I felt... What the person, they said they had a sore hand. I put my hand on the hook. Yikes, I could feel it. So I knew that the Holy Spirit was there within me, but I didn't speak in tongues. And that was, oh well, I worked.
Yes. So years went by in New Zealand, and then I think Chris got a job at Mwillimbah. It was supposed to be to close the school down, wasn't it? But that's not what happened.
Yes, we lived in Auckland for a while, and Chris worked at an inner city school and he decided this wasn't much fun. He'd like to go into Christian teaching. But in New Zealand, Christian schools were not the sort of schools he liked. They were the ones where each child has their own little cubicle and they sit with walls up between them and the next child and do their own work. And he said that's not his idea of school. And the only Christian schools that he liked were in Australia. So he said, right, we'll go to Australia. So we moved to, well, he put out a thing to the Australian Christian Schools, and said that he was wanting to come. And first of all, they said we could go to Perth. And I thought, oh, my parents are in South Australia. That's a long way with three kids in the car to go across the Nullarbor Plain. So we turned that down and got sent to Mwillimbah, which is a very small school. And the church thought it was going to close. It was run by the Baptists, and they thought Chris would come there and close it, but instead, he built the school up until it was big enough to build their own school.
Mm. All right, so after a period of time in Mwillimbah, you moved on to Bundaberg.
Yes, we had 7 years in Mwillimbah and the children went to high school there. And then the committee decided that they needed a different teacher to take the school in a different direction. And so Chris looked around for other schools and he got called to Bundaberg to start a Christian college in Bundaberg.
And it seems that your experiences in Bundaberg in the faith journey were quite marked, quite unusual, quite different.
Bundaberg was a place of real Christian growth in me, I think. It was a Pentecostal Church of Christ I was a bit worried about that because they were quite keen on speaking in tongues. And I had already heard from a friend when I lived in New Zealand that she said that she had been part of the Speaking in Tongues group, and she said, "It's not real, I made it all up." Oh. And so that stuck in my head. I thought, if it's going to happen, God, it has to happen like in the Bible. It's got to be real, it's got to be not me. And I also heard the people in the Baptist church there speaking in tongues behind me, around me in church, and I thought, they all say, sound exactly the same. I don't want to speak what I call Queensland Pentecostal, because in the Bible they spoke languages, different ones. So I had all these things. God, if you're going to let me speak in tongues, it's got to be this, 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 and this. So for a long time I didn't. And I did talk to a visiting speaker once, because the pastor we had did say that you should speak in tongues, and I wasn't going to say I didn't. I sort of kept a low profile there. And he said, a lot of people don't. He said, it's quite normal. He said, you might find it easier to sing in tongues. And so I tried that, and yes, I could. And then one day at a prayer meeting, a Sunday night prayer meeting, all of a sudden I just started speaking in tongues. And I could hear myself, and I thought, that doesn't sound like anybody else.
Not Queensland Pentecostal.
It wasn't Queensland Pentecostal. It sounded more Asian, if anything. And so now I can still speak in tongues, but I can't switch it on. I don't have control of the on button, because our last pastor in South Australia would say, all right, everybody pray in your heavenly language. And I thought, I don't have the switch. Mm. When God feels it's necessary, then all of a sudden I find myself able to speak in tongues over somebody. Maybe it's over somebody or some situation. And it's always, it sounds like a different language, and it's... Yeah.
It's always interesting to hear everybody's experience and how it differs from person to person. We're not all the same.
No.
I think you said that in Bundaberg you really experienced what real worship was.
We had a wonderful worship leader. She went down to Hillsong to the worship leaders conference every year and came back with all these things and teaching, and she really showed me the difference between singing in songs and what true worship was. And I think she did a lot of teaching in between her worship leading, but she just, I don't know, somewhere along the line I learnt that there was a difference between singing and worship. And that's when I joined... I joined a creative dance, worship dance group. A wonderful lady led it. Janine Chutsum knows her and saw her when she was there.
Yes, can I just interrupt and say that this was the place where your husband Chris met Bruce Chutsum, but you didn't actually meet Janine until down here.
No,
but
Chris and Bruce were teaching at the same school at one stage.
It's a little bit like sliding doors, isn't it? You know, you almost meet someone. Mm.
Yes. I joined this group, and then when the leader left... we didn't meet together very often, but I sort of took the group over. And I am not an out-the-front person like that. I can be a teacher, but not performing, not dancing. And so it was quite a stretch that God led me into this. And I found that when you dance a worship dance, it is really meaningful, because it goes right through you and it's sort of a whole part of everything.
Was this the place where God taught you things about creativity?
Yes, I was very good at taking over other people's unwanted jobs. I was treasurer of the church mission committee, which we met monthly, and there were four areas of missions that we supported, and there were four big pin-up boards around the church, and each one had a display advertising each kind of mission, and then we had a fantastic artist who used to come and put up artistic displays on each board. But she left and moved to, I think she went to Tasmania or somewhere, but a long way away from Bundaberg. And there was, the board sat there empty. And I thought, you can't have ambition work not being advertised. Nobody else can do it. Okay, I could do it. But do what? I cannot come up with an original idea for anything. Sewing, knitting, anything. Drawing. I can't come up with an original idea, but I can copy other people's ideas, adapt them, and make them my own. So I thought, right, okay, well, you don't find ideas for displaying mission work around anywhere. But I discovered that if I didn't think about it, God would suddenly put a picture in my head. I might be sitting in church and all of a sudden I'd just see this picture and think, oh, that would fit on that board. That show off that nicely. And he kept doing that for, I think I'd had this job for about a year. And I kept doing that. Once I had three boards done and I could not get anything for the fourth board. So I worked on it myself when I came up with my own idea. And nobody said a word, whereas all the other boards they'd come up and talk about and comment on. So that was a lesson too.
And was Bundaberg also the place where you became very interested in the Filipino community and your friend Maria?
Yes. The church had an outreach to the Filipino community because there were a large number of Filipino people living in Bundaberg. And so we had an outreach to them, and the Fortitude Valley Church in Brisbane had a Filipino pastor and a team of Christians there who used to come up once a month and minister to the local Filipinos. We had a big 5-bedroom house and our kids had left, so we accommodated them a lot, and I got to know one young woman who was studying at uni and needed somebody to proofread her assignments because she was brilliant, but her English was terrible. So I became friends with Maria and became to the stage where she told me her mother had died and she knew my daughter was living in England. So she said, right, you're my mother's age, you can be my mother. So she called, ever since then, for the last 25 years, she's called me mother. And she still rings up every fortnight to see how I am.
Yes, she rang up on one occasion when I was with you.
Yeah. Yes, and I had a long chat with her yesterday. Yes. And she called my mother her Nana. And my family, my relatives, they all adopted her into the family too. So she's my other daughter, my daughter from another mother.
Now, is Bundaberg also the place where you described a miracle to me, a miracle involving keys?
Yes.
Well, please tell us that story. It's magnificent.
I had forgotten this. But in church on Sunday, our pastor was talking about miracles. All of a sudden, I remembered this miracle that happened in Bundaberg. Okay, most people think of miracles as people being healed, things like that, or something like that. But this was, I think, a most unusual one. It was an extremely hot day. Chris was quite important in the life of the church and had a bundle of church keys, about 10 of them, I think, including the one that opened the mailbox, the church mailbox down at the post office, and he needed to get the mail. I think we had a meeting or something, but he needed to get the mail, so I said I'd go and get it. So I grabbed his bundle of keys, took up from the car, went to the post office, got the mail out, got back to the car and realised I'd locked the keys in the car. This was back
the car keys. You still had the other keys.
Yes, yeah. The car keys were locked in the car. And this was back in the days before press buttons and things like that. This was back in the olden days. And I thought, right, what am I going to do? Can't open it. No other doors were open. Boot wasn't open. There's no way of getting into the car. No spare keys kept anywhere on the outside of the car. It was very hot. I just had sandals on. Home's a long way away. It's 3-4 kilometres. Take me a long time to walk there in this heat. I don't have any water because no mobile phones. I can't call. Well, I think I might have had a mobile phone, just a simple one, but I couldn't call Chris because he was teaching. I didn't know anybody else's phone numbers. They weren't stored on the phone, if I even had one. But I think I had money. I could put it into a pay phone, but I couldn't phone up. What do I do? Trying to think what my options were. It didn't work many. And then I clearly heard a voice, which must have been God's voice or an angel or something, saying, what have you got in your hand? Which is what Moses was told. What's in your hand? And I thought, silly question, bunch of keys. And they're not car keys. Okay, well, bunch of keys. What have I got in my hand? A bunch of keys. Biggest one is the one that opens a post box, which is quite a long hefty key, but it looks nothing like a car key because a car key is quite big. But it's serrated on both sides and the post office box is smooth on one side. That's not going to fit, it's too big. No, of course it didn't fit. And I felt I had to go right through, so I tried the next house keys, church keys, all sorts of things. Of course, they didn't fit. And I thought, well, there's no point trying the last one because it was a tiny little key about that big, which a little bit bigger than a suitcase key, but not much more. And I thought, well, that's stupid. That's not going to do anything. Oh, well, it's the last one. I've got to try it. Stuck it in, and the car door opened. And it made me think of Naaman dipping himself seven times in the river. And I thought, okay, thank you. And that was just an amazing, amazing experience of God's goodness. And I was able to get into the car, get the car, proper car key, and drive home. Chris tells me, because he was telling me when he heard me talking to him about it with Yvonne, that he later went out with that key and tried it. He said, it wouldn't open the car door.
Really? Oh, you didn't tell me that bit.
He hadn't told me that bit. He said, that key wouldn't open it. But it did.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes. Mm.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Now, when you left, you had to leave Bundaberg because you went back to your roots. You went back to Mount Gambier to look after your parents who were getting older. What can you tell us about that time?
Yes, Chris was doing casual relief work at that stage, and my parents were told that they weren't doing too well, and I went home and saw they were not doing too well. They were still in their own home and they needed to get out of there. So I said to Chris, right, how about we move down to Mount Gambier? So we moved back. We found a house with a granny flat, a nice little modern two-bedroom granny flat in the backyard, and looked after my parents there, and I went to the local Baptist church. No, it's not a Baptist church. It's a New Covenant Ministries International Church, which is a worldwide movement that started in South Africa. And they're heavily into missions.
Yes, so you ended up going on a mission trip to Indonesia?
Yes, everybody in the church was encouraged if they could to do at least one, because they did two trips a year to an orphanage in the city of Medan on the island of Sumatra. And so Chris and I went 1 year because it was more of a practical trip than a teaching trip, because I'm not a Bible teacher, apart from Sunday school. I can teach Sunday school, but not adult groups. And so we went along and we worked in the orphanage, which took in 100 children. They were not all orphans. Some were just unwanted because the family had too many. So they dumped them in the orphanage because they couldn't feed them. They couldn't look after them. And we were there to minister to the kids, to paint the place, clean it up, repair anything that needed repairing. And then we went out at weekends to visit some of the churches and be part of their congregations and minister in whatever way we could there.
And eventually you left Mount Gambier and came back to Queensland to be nearer your grandchildren. I've got a few random photos now about your hobbies, your sculpting.
Oh, that was Mount Gambier before
we
came back.
Yes, okay.
Mount Gambier is part of the limestone coast. Everything's built on limestone, built of limestone, the houses, the fences, the roads, limestones, everything. And my daughter started learning to do limestone carving, and I thought this was a good idea, so I took up limestone carving as well.
So for someone who's not creative, it certainly looks a bit that way, doesn't it?
Well, again, I couldn't come up with an original idea.
That's okay.
I had to go through web pages and find pictures, and then I would print out the pictures, draw crosses through them all into boxes, and then draw the same crosses onto my limestone and copy them. And sometimes I adapted them.
Yes. And then I had to put in the dancing one. You and Chris had to put that one in.
Part of being part of the Tokoroa Pipe Band is that three or four times a year they have a Scottish night, a ceilidh, when you have the bagpipes playing, it's got Highland dances, and then you have community dancing too. So this is a little bit of fun.
Yes, and we've got one of your family. More up-to-date one than earlier ones that we've had. But I know that you've shared with everybody that you were delighted to be driving again, but I had to share this fact that when we spent a lot of time together talking about your life, I was driving home and I thought, Sandy didn't mention that she'd had a stroke. And when I got home, you'd sent a message on the phone saying, oh, I didn't mention the stroke, I suppose I should. So to me, it really typified your attitude to the stroke, that you've been very positive about it and you've just looked at the things that are good, like being able to drive again, even though there have been some limitations. So that seems to be part of your way of dealing with things.
Yes. It's the stroke now is sort of almost a non-event, except that there's still after effects. Like from here, I can't see Yvonne.
I'm here, but that's okay. We decided she could see you, not me.
Well, if I go like this, I can see you.
Yeah, okay.
But after about 6 or 7 months, my body just said, this is normal. This is my new normal. And in the recent months, it was like there was a curtain across that part of my face. Now it's moved across to about there. And when I look out over there, I can see right across. So I went back to the ophthalmologist and said, could you do another vision test? And he did one. The optometrist one wasn't very positive. He said, no, there's still an area of blindness. But the ophthalmologist said that the blindness is down here. And he said, when you're driving a car, you don't see down there. He said, across there, you're fine. So he's given me a restricted license. And so far, yes, I've been out about 13 or 14 times in the car and haven't even come close to an accident.
Well, thank you, Sandy. Thank you very much for sharing your life with us. And that attitude that you have, I think, is quite amazing. And the smile on your face and the way in which you approach everything that happens to you, I think is a very commendable way of doing it. Thank you.
And she still is a piper in the Caledonian Piper Band in Toowoomba with Chris. So, you know, carnivals and all the events there in this field.
Next one is on November the 9th.
November the 9th at
Drayton Hall.
Drayton Hall. Oh, she does.